The Nix is the debut novel of author Nathan Hill. It's the story of a woman who throws gravel at a governor and also of the son that she abandoned. But the New York Times has called it the great American novel. Nathan Hill is with me now in the studio. Hello there.
Hi there.
So how do you respond to being called the great American novel? Is that what you set out to write?
No, not at all. Yeah, I started this this book a long time ago. 2004 is when I first started writing this book. And hilariously, I thought I was writing a short story at the time. And it just kind of grew and grew and grew.
Hilariously, because listeners may not realize, this is quite a thick book.
It is. I hope that it reads quicker than it looks. But it's about, you know, it's about 600 pages. I hope that I try to give the reader a pretty good experience along the way.
Well, I think a lot of people like books that they can really sort of sink into.
I know I do. Yeah, I like to really kind of, I don't know, get really involved. I like to feel like I'm in somebody else's mind and in somebody else's family. So yeah, big books. I guess I just kind of wrote the kind of book that I like to read.
What was the short story? I mean, I'm interested now. I mean, because there's a lot of threads in this novel, and I'm going to try very, very hard not to do any spoilers during this interview. But which was the short story focused on?
Yeah, I always feel sorry for people who have to explain what this book is about, because there's a lot of stuff going on. At the heart of it, it's about a mother and a son, as you mentioned. The mother is named Faye. Her son is named Samuel. And Faye leaves the family when Samuel is 11 years old. And he doesn't see her again for a little more than 20 years until one day she's on the internet in a kind of viral video. And he decides to try to figure out not only what she's doing,
but only because there's major financial incentive to do
there's
so.
He's contracted to write an expose of his own mom to savage her very publicly and write a book about her. And then he discovers this big epic story that he never knew existed. I started the story in 2004. After I just moved to New York City, this was August 2004, and one of the things that happened my first month in the city was that the Republicans were having their presidential nominating convention at Madison Square Garden, and this was Bush Cheney's second term. The war in Iraq was ongoing, and so a lot of people came down to protest. And so I was like, "That's going to be interesting." So I went and watched the protests, and then promptly started writing a story about a guy who is one of the protesters.
I assume that either you play World of Warcraft or you know someone quite well who does, because there's information in there, like the fact that Tuesday's patch day and you don't get to play the game again until like 3 p.m. Eastern time. For those listening, if you don't play World of Warcraft, it's an MMORPG. That's a massively multiplayer online role-playing game. And it is... it plays a fairly crucial role in the story, because this is how Samuel meets... Pwnage, which is his online name. But you used to play...
Well, it sounds like you're quite familiar with it, too.
I am very familiar with it, yes.
You just outed yourself. you know what? Okay, so I started playing in 2004, about the same time I started writing the book. And the reason I started playing was because my first month in the city, this thing happened to me where my computer was stolen. And it was stolen out of my car on a day that I was moving apartments. And that computer had all of my writing from my graduate program. So like 3 years of writing and a manuscript in process was suddenly gone one day, and I had to start writing something new, and I was quite sad about that. And eventually
never got it back.
I never got it back. Yeah, so eventually I saved up enough money for another computer, and things weren't going well, as you can imagine. Things weren't going very well for me in the city. And I had a good friend. He calls me one day and he says, "Hey, I want you to buy this game, World of Warcraft." And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Just don't worry about it. Just buy it." And he told me later that he did it only to kind of keep an eye on me. You know, like I was really sad and alone in the city, and we could chat
Yeah, you can chat while you're in the... And you can see when someone comes online and goes offline. And I want to read this, because it might be the best description I've ever read of why video games like this are popular among adults. You say, quote, "If only the real world operated like Elfscape. When I was a jerk to Lisa, I'd lose points, and the closer I was to zero, the closer I'd be to divorce. It would also be helpful if these events came with associated sound effects, like that sound when Pac-Man shrivels up and dies." Like, the world in a game like that, you know when you're doing something positive or something negative, and it's all about points. But this novel is very much about uncertainties and unspoken things and people being unsure of how other people feel. How did that, for you in your mind, how did you pull that from World of Warcraft?
That is such a great question. I wrote I wrote the lion's share of the novel during the recession. And this was a time when it just felt like things were unraveling, you know, like all the old rules were going away. You know, you could lose your retirement nest egg in a second. Your house was suddenly worth half as much as you paid for it. And people were getting laid off. Unemployment was high. And it just felt like everything was kind of coming undone. But then I would think about my time playing this game and how linear it was, how hard work paid off. If you did enough, you would increase your level and you would get better and better and better. And there was a kind of payoff for hard work that seemed to be now irrelevant in the real world. And so that tension between what I saw happening to folks around me, to friends and relatives, and then what would happen in a game, it gave me the inspiration for this character who prefers being in the game to the real world.
Well, because the real world has not been particularly kind of him, possibly
right.
on his own fault. But let's talk about the title, which is The Nyx. And it's based on a Nordic myth that Samuel's mother heard from her father. And correct me if I have this wrong, but the Nyx originally was a horse that would lure children to ride it, and then it would lure them to their deaths, basically. It would
That's
jump
right.
off a cliff.
That's right.
And then eventually the Nyx is not a horse anymore. It's anything that is too good to be true. And the connection, it's very difficult for me to separate that from not only the recession that you were talking about, but the what's happening in the world right now. It's very much of the moment.
Yeah, the Nyx, it's spelled N-I-X, by the way. I have to do that or else people think I've written a basketball novel. As the story goes, the horse would present itself to these kids. And I was thinking about it from the kids' point of view. And when suddenly they got their own horse, it must have been the coolest thing that ever happened to them. And then, of course, tragedy struck. And it seemed relevant to me for a couple different reasons. First, as a metaphor for what was going on with my characters, all of them are sort of undermined by the very things that mean the most to them. So Samuel is undermined by the mother who abandons him. Ponage is undermined by the very video game that he's obsessed with, and so on and
Bishop
so forth.
Bishop was undermined by the military he obsessed over
right.
as a child.
Right, and Bethany is by her own twin brother. Is disowned by her own twin brother, and there's a character who is a workaholic who is then undermined by the very company he's been working for.
Yeah, he gets sick.
Yeah, that's right. And so, but then in a kind of larger sense, you know, it struck me while I was writing this that one of the reasons why the recession was so systemic was because of our trust in things we thought were too good to be true. You know, things like AAA rated mortgage backed securities and sovereign debt and so on. These things that we thought these will never go down suddenly went down. And so it was, you know, in part a reaction to what was going on, that one of the reasons why it was such a disaster is because we believed in things that were too good to be true.
Is the Nyx a real Nordic myth?
It is, yeah. It's known by different names. It's Scandinavian and Germanic. You know, every culture has a slightly different name for it. It's the Nyx or the Noxen or the Nocken, the Neck, the Nyxie. It depends on where you're coming from, but it is a real story.
Either way, it's still the moral is don't trust things that are too good to be true.
That's right.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with author Nathan Hill. His debut novel is The Nyx, N-I-X. So there's a large chunk in the middle, which is a choose your own adventure, but there's no choice in it until the very end. And it struck me that in a way, that's another running theme in the novel is this idea of choice that's not really choice. There's a part where Samuel's talking about the choice to go to New York City, and he says, how could it be a decision when you never considered saying no? But that's true of so many people in this novel. Did that also come from personal experience?
It did. I know that when I was a kid, I loved those Choose Your Own Adventure books. You know,
and, I wondered about that.
Yeah, and I would read them, I would put my thumb in an important decision and kind of look ahead and see if I was making
the right decision.
I totally cheated. And see if I made the right decision. And then if it looked like I made the wrong decision, I would like flip back. You know, and it struck
before
me
before you died.
Yeah, that's right. It struck me that that Samuel is looking back on this time that he went to New York City to try to win the heart of a woman that he's in love with and failed. And it struck me that he must be thinking about that the sort of the way I used to think about the choose, like if only I would have made a better choice. And so when I decided to write that section, I'm like, of course, I'll write it as a choose your own adventure section. But those things don't feel like like you're choosing your own adventure at the time. It feels like you're just kind of going with the flow. It feels like you're in a river and there's not much you can do about it, but kind of go with the current. And so, yeah, so it's a choose your own adventure section that has no choices until the very end. And then you're given a doozy.
So, I mean, so many novels, we just talked to a fiction writer who said if enough author tells you that they aren't writing about themselves, they're lying to you. So many novels, you pull things from your own personal life or things that you've observed. And I wonder if anybody that you know saw themselves in this book and came back to you and said, "What the heck?"
Well, I had to warn my mom. So, of course, the book is about a mother who is kind of cold and distant,
yeah,
and who abandons her family. And my own mom is warm and supportive and has never abandoned anything. So I had to warn her that she's going to find things that are pretty familiar, because when I was writing that character, she's a fictional character, but I wrap her up in a lot of real details. Like most of the characters, a lot of stuff from my own life or my parents' lives or my friends' lives, I steal and put in the book. So yeah, so Faye comes from the same small Iowa river town that my mom comes from, and I had to tell her, you're gonna see things that are familiar, but this is not you. Fortunately, she took that advice well, and she's a big fan of the book now, but I had to warn her.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about Molly Miller. So Molly Miller in the book is this pop singer who's ostensibly 17, but is actually 25. And she writes this, what sounds like an awful song, in which the repeated line is, you've got to represent. And nobody actually knows what that means. Do you hate pop music?
That's a great question. I don't. I just know that there's a lot of music out there that has, let's say, an ambiguous relationship with meaning. And in Molly Miller struck me as a way I could talk about kind of pop culture's obsession with facade. You know, she is all glitz, all glamour, but at the heart of it, there's kind of nothing going on in her music. You know, and she is produced by this media guru who ends up being a big character.
Yeah, he's a jerk. Yeah,
a big character in the novel, and he's kind of like, you know, he's that promoter who doesn't care.
Craven.
Yeah, he doesn't care what he promotes. It's just the message. As long as the message gets out, you know, he could be selling cigarettes. He doesn't care that they're bad for you. He just wants people to smoke more because that is his job. You know, he just gets the message out. And it kind of struck me that there's, like you said, like a kind of cravenness to media culture sometimes, where it's really just about, it's about like fame is the point, you know, and not, there's nothing kind of behind it.
So that kind of brings us to what I kind of felt was the undercurrent of the whole novel, which is the death of empathy in our world. You start early. There's this elite neighborhood that where they used a trick to build on a protected wetland. They put out salt licks to poison the deer, but just it acts slowly enough so that they return to the woods before they die. I mean, it's just awful. But that runs through the whole novel, this fact that people just don't have empathy for each other anymore. And I it made me wonder about whether or not you've kind of lost hope. I mean, if you write a 600-page novel, that's an expression of hope, is it not? But on the other hand, the book is a little bit sad.
It is. Yeah, that's such a great question, and you're among the only people who's put it exactly that way, and you're precisely right. I was worried about that while I was writing the book. I know that, you know, you're kind of writing by instinct, kind of writing by gut, you know, for a long time until you get several hundred pages down, and then you kind of realize what you've been saying all along. And one of the things I realized was that this was really, I thought it was going to be a book about politics when I first started it, but it turns out it's a book sort of more about polarization. And, you know, it's, we have, there are protests in 1968 and 2004. There's a guy who can't see beyond his own video game avatar. There's a college student who really can't see beyond her own social media image. You know, there are people who have created sort of bubbles for themselves and have trouble communicating with anybody outside of that bubble. So once I realized that's what I was writing about, I took a lot of opportunities to place it, to, you know, kind of make it a more aggressive theme. And you're right, that neighborhood is a great example.
It is. It's kind of the metaphor. The whole
thing. I guess your question about being hopeful. I don't know. I guess yes, because I feel like I end the novel in a more hopeful place. You know, yeah. I feel like I end the novel.
No spoilers.
I won't give it away. But I didn't want it to be a downer. I guess I can spoil that. I hope the ending is not a downer, because a lot of the characters learn to kind of see beyond the kind of unbreathable ideologies that they've been living in all along.
And what did it make you think? Did it make you rethink your own bubble that you lived in?
It did. I wanted the ending to be a reflection of the things that I learned along the way. There are a lot of characters in this novel that started as very two-dimensional and what I see now as caricatures of maybe people I might disagree with. And then it was clear that I had a certain kind of authorial disdain for those characters, and they just were not coming alive. And so I'm like, you know what? If I'm going to be a proper author, if I'm going to write a book that people are going to care about, I'm going to have to ask certain questions about these folks' lives. And that naturally leads you into more empathy when you start asking, well, why is this person behaving this way? Why do they think what they think and I think what I think? And ultimately, I chose this story about the blind men and the elephant for the epigraph that kind of sums up where I got to eventually. If you don't know the story, there's a king who asks all the blind men in a town to touch a part of the elephant, and then he asks them all, what is an elephant like? And of course they all have different answers. And so it struck me as a very tidy metaphor for kind of what's going on, that people are touching very different parts of the elephant.
And that is novelist Nathan Hill. He's author of the book The Nix. Nathan will appear for a reading and signing tonight at the Margaret Mitchell House at 7 p.m. Such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.